Thank you all very much for coming. As you probably know, unless you're in the wrong room and you stay anyway, I'm Luke Reed.
If you're going to stand, you're going to have no head.
Well, but I need a head.
that's
where most of my best reading comes from.
Okay, I think we got you.
And I'm going to read mostly stories from my collection, BAM, 172 Relaciously Short Stories. And a lot of them are actually due to this man over here. This is Rudy Dornemann, who started a site called The Daily Cabal, and a bunch of us for several years posted one new flash fiction piece every weekday for years. It was pretty great, and it forced me to write a lot of fiction, some of which I like. This one's called The Hydra Keeper. Every once in a while, some smart-ass kid sneaks a machete or something into this room, loads Edna over with junk food, and hacks off one of her heads. For the kids, it's a lot. For me, it's one more mouth to feed. If you're going to look after a Hydra, you got to be dedicated. You have to realize that things are always going to get more complicated in the long run, never simpler. Take love, for example. If you're alone, it's the simplest thing in the world. No double families to juggle at holidays, no having to orient the toilet paper the right way. But then you fall in love. All of a sudden, you're making accommodations and trying to remember the anniversary of your first date. Mm-hmm. Getting out of it isn't exactly simple either, which is why I think some people opt for marriage, which is even more of a mess. Not even mentioning children. And then you gotta realize it was never gonna work out in the first place, and you get divorced, and instead of having one person who more or less likes you, you got one person who more or less hates you, who usually starts going out right away with someone else who hates you. Notice that doubles? And likely as not, you're on the rebound, and you're going out with someone anyway, so it's not even like you simplify anything there. At least, when it gets more complicated with Edna, you know what you're going to get. One more head, one more set of teeth to charge, and 15 more pounds a day of fresh meat. I still like it better, though, when the kid leans through the bars, and Edna eats the little creep instead of getting one of her heads chopped off. First of all, teaches all the other smart-ass kids a lesson. Second, there's one last person, which makes the world a little tiny bit simpler for a while. This one is, I wrote a series of these, God knows why, but it's called Cinderella Begins Dating Again After a Bitter Divorce. You look beautiful, he said. Don't be charming, snapped Cinderella. Cinderella's date looked confused. After a few seconds of silence, he took a sip of his Chianti. It was a peasant's idea of an acceptable wine. Cinderella ignored hers. Though charming probably wasn't drinking much of the better stuff these days after the settlement. It was like he'd gotten to keep the cobwebby old chalet where he now had to live. As far as Cinderella was concerned, he was lucky he'd gotten anything at all after his fling with Sleeping Beauty. She believed him when he said he'd never meant to start anything with her, but there was such a thing as being too charming. Her date smiled at her. What was his name again? Hans, Jan, something like that. He was handsome in a chunky, woodcuttery way. He smelled like ginger. That wasn't bad, ginger. It made Cinderella think of pumpkin pie. Mm-hmm. So, Cinderella, he said, what do you do? I do? Nothing. I used to scrub floors and frolic with the forest creatures. They weren't welcome in the palace. They will be now, if they still have any idea of who I am. You like animals? I like animals, he said in a rush. Then his face grew red. Sorry, that sounds desperate. Better than charming, she said. There was a long silence, and she tapped one foot impatiently. She grimaced. When's the waiter going to be here with our salad? Hans or Jans or something sighed and stood up, dropping a few coins on the table. Let's try this another time, he said. Cinderella stared, uncomprehending, as Hans or Jan or something bowed awkwardly and walked to the door. What was he doing? Cinderella was beautiful, obviously rich. She had a lovely singing voice. He was leaving, just like that. She waited for a long moment, but he didn't come back. Apparently, he was leaving, just like that. Cinderella ran out to the parking lot, not losing her shoe because she had long since taken to wearing ones with straps. There was nothing out there but a few enchanted cars surrounded by thick forest. Cinderella looked all around her, the anger draining away. He wasn't charming. Why had she been taking it out on him? An ancient bluebird flapped arthritically to the ground and trilled at her. She looked down, surprised. Next to the bluebird lay a white stone, gleaming in the moonlight. They didn't realize it wasn't even finished yet. And there was another, and another, a trail. She picked a breadcrumb off her blouse and threw it to the bird, then followed the rocks into the dark forest. Hansel, that was his name, Hansel. The next one is called the Autonomous Assistant. Oh, I should have warned you at the beginning. Doors aren't locked. I'll tell you anyway. I tried to choose stories where I could do some voices. I love doing voices. You're welcome to boo if the voices start getting to be too much. I won't listen, but open that up. Okay, the Autonomous Assistant. That's the last time I'll say it because it's hard to pronounce. Darling, squeaked Eleanor, pulling the covers over her body as she scrambled out of bed. What are you doing home at this hour? Her husband's new assistant, Mr. Twall, slept completely naked on the mattress. I was looking for Mr. Twall, said Horace, the husband. I hadn't realized there was a cue. I don't know what to say, said Mr. Twall. I'm profoundly sorry. It isn't your fault, Twall, Horace reassured him. Eleanor, I'll have you know that Mr. Twall is one of my biomechanical automatons. I purposely created him to see if he would be unfaithful to me.
Oh, not,
protested Mr. Twall. Of course, I programmed him not to know this. Mr. Twall, would you be so kind as to recognize shutdown code 5RR4?
Certainly,
said Mr. Twall, apparently to his own surprise. Then he went utterly limp.
You bastard! You pustule! Said Eleanor.
Call me whatever name you like, but I had to test you. I suspected you had fallen out of love with me, but hadn't cared to bring it up.
You suspected right. And is it any wonder? It isn't easy, you know, to find out that one's husband will not become less emotionally frozen. The clumsiness of his intimacy is not something one can correct. I was wrong to think you could be better.
Eleanor dropped the covers with a warning glare, swept up her clothes from the floor, and strode out of the room. Horace stood frozen for a few moments, then slowly walked over to Mr. Twall and popped open his neck panel to erase all the unpleasant incident and the inclinations that led to it from the automaton's brain. He found, though, that his hands were shaking. He had to sit down on the floor as he began to cry. It was just gasping and tears at the corner of his eyes at first, but it quickly degraded into hoarse, barking sobs that he couldn't stop or even quiet down without clamping his hands tightly over his mouth. The naked automaton looked on blankly, still inert, as the sound of Eleanor slamming the front door reverberated through the house. All right, the next one is called Random Sampling.
You will stand up now,
said the other one. You speak English? I said. I was still reeling from being sucked from my bed and out through the window by a ray of ochre light. Now I lay sprawled on the metallic floor of a triangular room. It was windowless, doorless, unfurnished, and featureless, except for some faint raised patterns on the floor, walls, and ceiling. My clothes hadn't been transported with me, and I was just about scared enough to pee myself.
Your question is a kind of stupidity, said the man,
a tall, rubbery, bulge-eyed, gray man.
You will stand up now, or we will encourage you.
I didn't want to think about what encouraging me would involve. I scrambled to my feet and waited. The floor opened up in front of me and a small table rose into view. On it were four very pieces of cheesecake, each on a black triangular plate. There was a clear, glittering 10-inch fork beside each plate.
You will taste the cheesecakes now and render your opinion.
I stared at the cheesecakes. Was this a joke? No, nobody I knew had such a sick sense of humor or the necessary access to hardcore hallucinogens. Cheesecake? I said.
You will render your opinion. It is why you are here.
You abducted me to taste test cheesecake?
All other methods result in inadequately randomized focus groups, said the alien. We will take over your Earth by monopolizing your economic assets. Who sells up cheesecake? We must know which is the most triumphant recipe.
My choices were limited, so I picked up a fork and started eating cheesecake.
I'll spare you the details, the involuntary groans, the amazement, the delight, the rapture, The short version is that numbers 1, 2, and 4 were each much better than the best cheesecake I had ever had. But number 3, it was in a class beyond all food. I wept tears of joy while I ate it.
It is number 3, then? Said the alien. Number 3 is very popular.
I nodded. How can something like that even exist? That was a religious experience.
It is also 0 calories. And now we are finished.
That's it, I said, disbelieving. I'm done. I can go home.
You are done, said the alien, reaching for me. But you will not be going home.
All right. So this next one is actually not from BAM. This is from the book some of you have seen, Talk the Talk, The Sign of 65 American Cultures, Subcultures. It's the table of contents. And I would anyone be willing to volunteer to kind of ease me into it? But I need you to say something along the lines of, what you got in that there book, mister? You can be creative with it. Anyone? I can do it myself, but thank you, Larry.
What you got in that there book, mister?
Well, there's truckers, hikers, hikers, and there's bicyclers and bikers. There's skiers, scuba divers, and a prostitute or three. Anime and sci-fi fans, thespians and lesbians. Fans of tats and advocates of sustainability. Ufologists, serpologists, some parapsychologists, witches and astrologists. And antarcticologists, carers, cowboys, kayakers, and hunters, hams, and fishermen. Cat and gun enthusiasts, philatelists, numismatists. We have beekeepers and birders and politicos and prisoners. Puppeteers, pro wrestlers, rail fans, also more. Drug pushers, poker players, furry scots and SCAers, skateboarders and snowboarders, and circus folk galore. There's gladies and there's channelers, bodybuilders, gardeners, graffiti writers and rock climbers, rocketeers to burn. We've got prestidigitators, online gamers, VFAers, dungeon masters, reenactors, and some rappers, as you'll learn. At last, my list is almost through with naturists and skinheads too, hot rodders and RVers. Now my song is nearly done. Skydivers and punk rockers make the last few talk to talkers. That's all, my friends, and in the end, I hope you had some fun. Hey!
Thank you, Gilbert and Sullivan.
I didn't want to do a traditional table of contents. Really. The problem was that after I wrote that book, people would say, oh, that's called 65 Subcultures, what's in it? And I'd be like, they're, you know, gamers, stamp collectors. It's very sad. I was very focused on it while I was writing it, but apparently I did not file away the subcultures in any accessible form until I put it to music. Okay, this one is called, This one is called Handsome Martha and the Sycophants. Sycophants. I keep wanting to say something to rhyme with elephants, but it's sycophants, they tell me. Outside Martha's Easer Lounge, rangy man in a navy blue three-zipper business suit inserted a tiny recording disc into a little machine in his pocket and then turned on the hidden microphone. He watched Easer slip through the door into the place, one after the other. The longer he waited, the more of them he'd get. Inside the club, Martha nodded to Willie the Grinner and some of the other Easers who were filling up the seats. Willie loosened his foiled tie, pulled off his company hat, and collapsed into a red plush chair at the table near the stage. The man get you today, Willie? Martha said. Not today, Martha. I asked the man like anything today. Martha's was a club for the Ease cast, also called the Courtesan cast or the Happy cast, born into a life that offered the following job opportunities. Entertainer, maitre d', professional mourner, office sycophant, political sycophant, celebrity sycophant, prostitute, cheerleader, gigolo, receptionist, vice president, and tour guide. After a hard day of sucking up, Easers came to Martha's to spend the evenings bad-mouthing their bosses and clients in relative safety. Bad-mouthing was forbidden to Easers. It could get you 5 years in prison for the first offense, and sometimes in the prisons they had a way of forgetting exactly how long you'd been there. That was why an out-of-the-way club like Martha's, with its inconspicuous lookouts and careful bouncers, did so well. That and Martha herself, because she could belt out a hell of a tune. Martha mounted to the stage, patting Nicky, the pianist, on the shoulder of his frayed red jacket as she passed by. Evening, Martha, Nicky said, sending his fingers and little arpeggiating sprints up and down the keyboard. The man in the three-zipper suit came in just as Martha reached the microphone, and he drew her attention while Martha herself drew everyone else's attention. He smiled easily, seemed to know people, shook hands, glanced at her on the stage. All in all, he didn't do anything funny, but he did seem like an easer to her. It was probably how he was being so polite. The last thing an easer wanted to do at the end of the day was be polite. Yet he had to have his easer card if Betty had let him in the front door, which meant maybe he was okay. Or maybe he was government, coming to catch up badmouthers, in which case they were all in some serious trouble. "Nikki, give me, you got my heart in your hands in B flat," she said. Martha knew she wasn't pretty. She was too sturdy for that. Her nose was too large and too proud. She was handsome. She could own a song in a way that made it sound like it was her song. But something that happened to her would break her heart if she didn't tell you about it then and there. This one, she sang to the guy in the three-zipper suit. She sang she knew he had his cast job to do, just like anyone else. She sang he knew he could take down a little on-the-precipice joint like hers. She sang what it felt like to be an easer, what the lounge meant to her, and how she didn't know how people had got themselves in this caste system mess in the first place. First the guy smiled, then he looked impatient. By the time he was done, he looked worried. He must not have realized he was walking toward the stage the whole time because he looked around him confused when he got there. She stepped down and guided him by the arm toward her private table. "I know you," he said. "Everybody knows me," said Martha. "No, I know you. You're no easer. You were born into the Watcher cast, like me. I saw your picture at headquarters. You were high up." "No," Martha said. "I've never been so high up as I am now." She reached for his hand, but he pulled away. He looked around the place at the easers, then looked into Martha's face. Finally, he reached into his coat and popped out the little recording disc. As he stood, he laid it on the table. "I don't belong here," he said. "No," she said as he was walking away. "But you're welcome anytime." This next one is called Or. Or, he realized, lifting his hand from the big red button, as the universe began to come apart, he could have read the instructions first. This one's called In the Elevator with Albert Einstein. "I shouldn't have been up on that roof in the first place, but I kept thinking I could save a lot of money if I fixed it myself. Then I tripped over my own hammer. The roof tumbled by in a blur as I tried like hell to separate my up from my down. My cheek scraped against the eaves. I went into free fall and crack! Skull meets driveway. My 8-year-old Jenna was playing in the front yard. She saw the whole thing. She was probably traumatized for life. Jesus. And then I was in an elevator with some guy. A familiar looking guy. 'Are you Albert Einstein?' I said. 'No, no,' he said. There was a silence while he studied the elevator buttons, dozens of them, in an intricate layout. 'I used to be,' he said conversationally. 'But you see, I died. Where does this elevator go?' 'I don't know. Up?' 'Up,' he said, springing up and down on the floor. 'It seems possible. Are you dead?' 'I think so,' I said. I thought of that last flickering moment of seeing bits of bloody brain splattered across my driveway. I hope so. The elevator pinged and Einstein's attention leapt to the door. It opened on a... I wasn't sure. There were tables with people sitting at them and talking animatedly, cups of coffee, something that might have been macaroons. 'It's a cafe,' said Einstein. 'Fair incursion, I'll get off you. And you?' I didn't know. Einstein stepped out, waiting for me to follow. It was much larger than it had looked. There were no walls, just wooden floors stretching into the distance, and far off a night sky blazing with stars. From many tables away, an old woman was running toward me, an old woman who looked like Jenna. And it seemed to me that everyone might arrive at the cafe at about the same time. Before she reached me, there was a collective, 'Ah!' and everyone looked up. I looked for Einstein, but he had moved away. Jenny took my hand just as the stars began to fall, streaking through the sky with all the inappropriate iridescence of gasoline in a mud puddle. "You really freaked me out that day you died," she said. "I know," I said. "I'm sorry." Then we watched the sky fall for a while. And that's the end.